Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're going to talk this hour with Michael Hart. Michael Hart wrote a trilogy of books with Antonio Negri called Empire, that was one, Multitude, and the latest is called Commonwealth. He's a professor of literature and Italian at Duke University. And these books that have come out have become some of the most original thinking on the left, most original thinking in the world of working class politics, some of the most original in thinking about how we can change our world, some of the most original thinking about its critique of modern day capitalism. And Michael will be speaking tonight, by the way, at 7 o'clock after he leaves here. He's going to dash downtown, and the conversation will take place at the 2640 space, which is at 2640 St. Paul Street in Charles Village. Red Emmes is sponsoring the event, and he'll be there, but he's here right now in studio. And Michael Hart, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great. I'm glad to be here.
Number here is 410-319-8888. So just a little background. How did you end up hooking up with Antonio Negri to write these series of books? You're different generations, different countries. His experience as a kind of a radical revolutionary in Italy and in Western Europe. How did you two connect?
Well, you know, I was of that USer generation. You know, I finished college in the early 80s where it seemed like, or we felt like, you know, maybe we were stupid, that in order to make revolution, we had to go to Central America. I mean, that was sort of like, it seemed so, you know, I went first to Nicaragua and then spent most of the time in El Salvador, first working with the sanctuary movement and then in El Salvador. And from that perspective, I became somewhat frustrated. In fact, I remember one story at the University of El Salvador where I was working with a student group. There was an event, and my friend and I were there, and they started the event by saying, you know, we wanted to thank our North American comrades for, you know, coming here. But then they said, well, and a friend of mine who was saying this, who I'd known for quite a while, he said, you know, well, it would be better for us if you would go back to the U.S. and make revolution there. And I thought, oh shit, you know, it's like, I'm sorry, I said it can't, you know, it's the second Reagan administration by then, and I couldn't, you know, I felt like I couldn't say to him, I don't know how to make revolution in the U.S. And he said, well, don't you have mountains there? And I said, yeah, well, of course we have mountains. He says, simple. You go to the mountains, you start an armed band, you make revolution. And I thought of how much of a disjunction it was from our experience in the U.S. And so from that perspective, I had read and was continuing to read about what had happened in Italy in the 1970s. Autonomous movements based in constructing alternative communities, alternative radios, working class politics that were both inside and outside the factory. That seemed so much closer to what I could imagine in the U.S. And so reading Tony Negri's work and reading really a whole body of other things that were going on in Italy in the 70s, it seemed to me that that was a better alternative to me. And so really I met him. You know, I purposefully met him. In fact, I translated one of his books in order to meet him because he was clandestine in Paris at the time, with the idea that would sort of correspond better to thinking, to be able to think about how to change a society like ours. And so not to be, you know, I'd felt previously an observer of someone else's revolution and also something, a kind of politics that wasn't adequate for us. And so that's what it attracted me. And then, and then there were a whole other series of stages really in Tony and my working together. But
one of the things that overarching before we get into some specifics about the books, especially this notion of the commons you're developing now as the latest thinking, which I think I find very interesting in terms of how to grasp some of the issues we face, is that Tony Negri in Italy came out of a revolutionary kind of student movement and other things that happened in Italy. Started by the Catholic Workers Movement way back when.
In the
50s, as many people did here, which was a nonviolent movement.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those folks are here in this city now who do a lot of work. And then in the late 60s, early 70s, some of the movements in the Western world kind of morphed into a very violent stage.
Mm-hmm.
Here in this country, it didn't take the place of killing people, but it took place of blowing up buildings and other people getting killed who were in that movement. In Italy and some other places, in Germany, it took place of actually kidnapping and killing people that they would call the capitalists, the oppressors, whatever name people wanted to use back then. And all those things kind of proved really inadequate. I mean, they didn't, they might have made a feel-good burst, but they didn't do much to move anything forward or to change anything. And so I wonder when when you think about transformation of societies like ours, which is really the bulwark of the world in terms of where the money has come from and international capital, what does that mean to you? What does it mean to transform and change a place like this? It's not directly. It's directly out of your books, but it's kind of on the side of that, I guess.
Right. One thing is I think it's important to recognize the possibilities of transformation here and now in our own communities, and not think about revolution or radical social transformation as only something that can happen that can happen elsewhere. Through the construction of, I might say in a certain kind of lingo, the construction of autonomy, but the construction of community control is a construction of self-organization. And it seems to me something that, in fact, the groups that interested me in the 70s, because it was a big split in the 70s in Italy between the terrorist groups mm-hmm. and the non-terrorist autonomous groups, that a lot of the practices of those autonomous groups were very like some of the practices of the Black Panthers in the U.S., of the construction of communities, of taking control of the community, the breakfast program, et cetera. These are all ways of starting from a position of autonomy and then thinking from there about the possibilities of social transformation. That seems to me at least one key. That has to be combined. I mean, this is again an interesting thing about the Panthers and about the groups out of which Tony comes, is there's a combination between a very local and practical community transformation and taking control with a very large scale theorization of how power works in the world, even at the most largest global level. It's putting those two things together that I think is part of what we're struggling with in a good way in these books.
When you, as we move towards the comments, which I'm going to get to in a minute, mm-hmm. I'm just kind of trying to work my way over there, mm-hmm. is earlier today I interviewed Annie Leonard, who has this website about stuff, and it's like taken off around the world, 7.5 million people looking at it, and people using it as a way to kind of talk about our consumer ways in the West and how it's destroying ourselves and the planet and the rest. And I asked her a similar question, and because I said, you know, when you look at Capitol Hill here in our country right now, it's the immense power the corporations have, where they want to destroy a health care bill or try to stop the climate change bill from going through and not regulate banks and not all that going on. And I said, so what's your response to that? And she was talking about, well, across the globe, there are tens of thousands of small groups of people who said enough is enough. We have to kind of take our lives back and take our world back. And I think that it feels like in some ways we're in this period where people are actually groping for how to confront all of that.
Right.
You know, that's the frustration and the kind of dialogue and intent of the moment, I think, in some ways, just trying to figure out where we go, because you look at you look at the election of Obama, and no matter what people thought about that, it mm-hmm. did give people hope, okay, we have something more sane to battle and talk about rather than what we had before. So what do you think, what does that dynamic say to you in your sense of the commons and where you see the world?
Well, I would start here, which is it's in a way a difficult place to start, which is it seems to me that in these questions about economic crisis, the current state of capital, et cetera, there seem to be two alternatives that we're given. Either private property will solve all the problems of state control, or public property or state regulation or state control will solve all the problems of private property. It seems that we were on those two things, either market or state regulation, in some senses either neoliberalism or a version of Keynesianism or socialism. And so what we're trying to think, and I think this notion of the common tries to capture, is something that is outside of either private property or public property, that the common is not property in that sense, and that it might give, I think, the kinds of local experiences you were talking about, experiences of self-organization, are experiences in the common, and maybe help us recognize what the regulation or the construction of social relationships, the kinds of autonomous organization outside of property relations could look like.
So let's talk about it. I mean, so let's, there's different definitions of the commons. I mean, you talk about the commons in your book as the commons being something that is held, that is not held by anybody, but exists.
Yeah.
And the other side of commons is the commons that are held in private hands and the relationship to that.
Right. I would start with two different aspects of what we're thinking of as the common, which in some ways are very close and in other ways are distant. The first is the common, which you might call the natural common, but that's actually a bad way of thinking of it. But the natural common, meaning the air and the earth, the water, the the things that we share that in some ways seem given. And that's in a way the traditional notion of commons with an S from a long European tradition of talking about this. But what we're more actually focused on in this book is the way that the common, a different kind of the common, which is really the product of human creativity, is becoming central in the capitalist economy. And these things of common, I think of like ideas, images, even affects and social relations, but also code. These are obviously the products and often products of economic production, but they at least tend to be common. Like when they're transformed into property through patents, copyrights, etc., they in some ways cease to function. They become unproductive. Mm-hmm. So that thinking about these two notions of the common, let's say, on the one hand, the natural common, and the other, the artificial common, or really, let's say, the common that seems given, and the common that we produce. Putting those two together is partly what we're thinking of here, and recognizing our wealth, like the wealth we have as a society in those terms. That seems to us like the first step, to recognize those things as common, and then learning how to manage them or trying to figure ways to manage them. That's really the next step.
You know, listeners are joining us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking with Michael Hart, who co-authored a trilogy of books. The first one was Empire. The second one was Multitude. This one is called Commonwealth. He wrote this with Antonio Negri from Italy. He's professor of literature and Italian at Duke University. Tonight at 7 o'clock, we'll be speaking at 2640 St. Paul Street in Charles Village with Red Emmers. And I'm curious to see what you, our listeners, think at 410-319-8888 about where we are as a culture and society. Where are we in terms of the power of corporations in our lives? You see what's going on with foreclosures, with banks, with taking over, with agribusiness and what they're doing. And what your response to that is, what you think our response should be as a people, as a community, how do we address that? Sometimes it seems like voting people in and out of office doesn't always make it. What do you think we should do? 410-319-8888. Because the voting people in and out of office in the system we have now doesn't seem to create many changes. I think you're seeing a lot of people very frustrated, as much as they like Barack Obama, as much as they're looking at his appearance, as like looking at him, hearing his speeches. More and more people are going, so what's changed?
well, you said about 10 minutes ago something that seems to me a very intelligent way of starting to propose it, which is that that we now have in the U.S. a much more rational system to be opposed to, like that in a way, if it were to be the case, and it's possible that soon it could be the case that we don't have to fight and struggle against a government that has torture as a policy, that seems to have imperialist designs, etc., that it could be a much more intelligent and creative point to oppose. It has, though, I mean, one has to recognize, and I think it's an important thing for activist communities to struggle with, is that in some ways the election of Obama has created a kind of impasse among activist communities, because in some ways, you could say that with Bush in the office, conceptually, a certain kind of political activism was easy. I mean, conceptually, it's easy because it was just a matter of opposing. I think with the Obama government, there has to be some different stance, and so So there's been a kind of, what should we say, a quiet period, even with regard to things like the war on Afghanistan, that there hasn't yet been a way of recognizing how political activism can not so much oppose Obama as if the Obama government's the same as the Bush government, and yet contest it antagonistically in order to push forward, to even push forward what the government wants to do. I think that we're still in a period of a certain kind of, wouldn't exactly call it disorientation, but a certain kind of impasse of trying to figure out the relationship, the possibilities of relationship of antagonism, protest, and a certain kind of political activism with respect to the new government.
I don't think we've seen, I think people have quite figured out what the form of change is going to take. What will be the form of change? I mean, right. I think we're just in a very different place. Let me open the phones up. 410-319-8888. Michael Hart is with us, who wrote the books with Antonio Negri, Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth. He's speaking tonight at 2640, at the 2640 space, which is at 2640 St. Paul Street. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Jeff, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark. I was calling to talk about B corporations, a concept I read about for the first time today, and wanted to see if you are...
What's a B corporation?
A B corporation is a new entity that started coming into existence about 2 years ago, and it doesn't just measure sort of corporate product and service offerings, but also measures total impact, like on the commons. A concept that's been around for the last 2 years, and there's about 200 different companies that have been certified as B corporations. I wanted to see if maybe your panelist was familiar with that, and I'll take my question off the air. Thanks.
Joe,
I'm not familiar with it. If I'm understanding correctly and not mistaken, it's somewhat like, or it'd be related to a certain kind of notion of rationalizing prices or the costs of commodities. For instance, if one were to charge for gasoline, calculating in all of the damage done to the environment and other costs, then the price could be, in that sense, rationalized to something much higher than it is now. I don't know, $15, $20 a gallon. Or similarly with tobacco and the price from healthcare. It seems like this is sort of what I understood when the caller described it as measuring the total impact. That all, if I'm understanding correctly, this all seems like a helpful, almost pedagogical tool for recognizing what are often passed as hidden costs of the current functioning of corporations, certain ways of doing business. I guess it such and in that sense, such pedagogical, helping reorient people's understanding of how capitalist corporations and the economic world works can only be a good thing. It doesn't seem to me, if I'm understanding correctly, an end, but maybe a means towards a kind of public education, if I'm understanding.
It seems that that in many ways the world is in an interesting fix. I mean, we have an economy that is based on a consumer economy, on our selling obsolescence, and on manufacturing things we don't always need. In other words, you can, if my father bought a mop back in 1950, well, I still have that mop, and that mop still works. Maybe it'll change the head, but the mop works. It's got a wooden handle, and you clean the floors, and the mop is there. You buy a mop today, and the mop is made of plastic and made of all kinds of other chemicals and breaks 8 months later, and you have to go buy another mop. So our conception of what makes an economy is really been turned on its head, especially in the last 60 years. But people, we begin to think, we all do, I do too, that we need those things, that those are the things we have to keep buying to keep surviving in this world without realizing our relationship to what we're just buying and what it has done, that you couldn't buy that mop without exploiting somebody in the Congo. So I'm saying, we're so separated from those things. It's hard to put those back.
Yeah, let me try. It's usually my habit on a radio conversation, sometimes it's a little bit hard to do these things, but to step back a little bit and think, I'm wondering, what if we thought about commodities slightly different than that?
Okay.
Like even from the perspective of, you know, when I was saying earlier that part of our argument is even that the central and determining aspect of the economy today is not so much the production of material goods, but really the production of what we think of as immaterial goods, like the production
book,
of ideas,
right,
or
right.
images or code or affects or a number of other things that are play a central role in the economy. Well, what these are really producing is producing social relationships or producing forms of life. So that in a way, I think from this perspective, or if we were to accept this, it can cast in a different light looking back on a whole economic history of the production of commodities. So that it's not so much that the commodity is the end point, like the production of the automobile or the production of the refrigerator, but rather what matters, I think, to capitalist relations is the production of the social relationship implied in that. So the production of the refrigerator is in part the production of the nuclear family around that refrigerator. The production of the automobile is really the production of the kind of isolation of everyone together in his or her car on the highway. So that I think it doesn't yet answer the real problem you're pointing to about superfluous things and waste and waste for profit, etc. But it poses a challenging way of thinking what capitalist society is really oriented towards, and then the point at which perhaps we need to both contest it and take back the products of it. So if we're focusing not so much on those things, but rather at the social relationships implied in them and the ideas, in some ways these immaterial elements might be, in fact, the point of the crucial point and the point of attack that's more important. I know that I've sort of – it's not exactly a immediately practical perspective I'm giving, but one that gives a different view on the whole and I think does have implications for what kinds of political practice are not only appropriate but effective.
So how do you take your ideas of the commons, let's say,
yeah,
and turn them into something people can put their hands around as a vehicle to kind of change their society and change their lives and change the structures that they face?
Well, in some ways, we're struggling around them all the time. I mean, what it matters, I think one thing to do is to try to put together the different ways we are. For instance, with music industry or with computer software, we're constantly – well, first of all, we're constantly breaking the law all the time, you know, by copying music, by rendering common something that the privatization of which seems like a violation. You know, it seems like a violation that ideas aren't, you know, that aren't common. You know, when they become private property, when music does, or when certain images do, when, I don't know, the Happy Birthday song is private property, other things like this, it seems a kind of violation. So we already are, I think, struggling with those the transformation into private property of things that we need, you know, that we need and that we want. And I think this is really what's useful in the books that Tony and I write in general, is putting together things that, that different people are saying in different parts of the world, in different even academic disciplines, but also even in our own heads, in our own lives. Like, so putting together, for instance, the struggle over the common, which has to do with the privatization of the water or the privatization of the land and the kind of destruction done by that, together with the privatization of this, what I'm saying, calling immaterial realm, the privatization, like even, for instance, what in Brazil and India they call biopiracy, you know, when the medicinal value of a plant is privatized by a corporation, you know, it was produced by an indigenous community centuries ago.
Right.
But it was common, of course, the knowledge that this plant, you know, that the bark of this tree has this medicinal property. They produced it, of course. They produced that knowledge, but they produced it over a long period of time, and there isn't a specific person that they could say, you know, that guy created that notion. But then when it becomes private property, we can recognize that's a struggle with the common. In fact, they call it biopiracy. I don't like that name really, because pirates at least have the dignity to steal property. Here, this biopiracy, the corporations are stealing the common and making it into property. But I was just saying that these are, once one starts stitching together the ways that people are already are in their lives struggling over preserving and even furthering the common, if that can give you a vantage point for seeing a more general outlook on this.
So when you talk about that kind of common in your book, I mean, when you talk about being able to own the genetic code of Iceland.
Exactly, right. That's a great example.
You know? And you attach that to the understanding of how you can, that someone could buy and own chunks of or the entire Amazon River.
Yeah.
That those things are connected in terms of a new kind of definition of what private property means.
Yes, I mean it's both an evolution.
They can own our DNA.
They can own right. They can own and they can own in all these rents. I mean, so Tony and I use the term, you know, somewhat annoyingly, we both make up terms and use. so we call it. We try to refer to this in terms of biopolitical elements or even biopolitical production. What we mean is really these things that are forms of life. That's why we're the bio part of it. So what's being owned here is not just, I don't know, a car or even an iPod, but rather forms of life that either in like forms of life in terms of genetic code or a certain species of mouse or certain kinds of plants or trees, which are in fact all strangely enough owned. But even then thinking about how code and circuits of ideas and those kinds of productive relationships are also forms of life, that it reorients our thinking about what capitalist property is and or even what is central to capitalist property today and what ways we need to struggle against it, both to I think of it not only also as a defensive question, like we have to preserve what's common from capital, we also have to recognize there are many ways in which we are much more powerful than in a previous era with the relation, the expanding relationship to the common that we have. It's very different than when we're struggling over the ownership of material goods. We have already a different and in some ways more powerful relationship. I mean, Tony and I, because it's already our way of thinking about it, put it in a long history of working class struggles and that this is in a way a new phase and in our view, much more powerful phase, with more potential of working class struggle.
And I'd like to hear what that means. I mean, in more detail, because I mean, I'm not, you know, when you're talking about people fighting over not being kicked out of taking over a factory in Chicago and saying we're not leaving this factory in Chicago until you pay our which you owe us, or you're polluting, you're killing us with the pollution in our neighborhood, and setting up a battle there, and connecting that to the idea of owning things that are non-material and controlling our lives with it. Mm-hmm. So we'll come back to that. Take a short break. Michael Hart's our guest. Michael Hart is the co-author with Antonio Negri of the books Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth. The number here is 410-319-8888. Urbanite Radio Stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by the National Connections Academy, an accredited online private school with affordable tuition for grades K through 12. Visit nationalconnectionsacademy.com for more information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite looks at growing up in the city with its youth issue, featuring stories on child prodigies, the lives of teenagers, arrested adolescents, and how Baltimore can beat poverty by creating children's zones. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. You can visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. We're joined in studio right now by Michael Hart, H-A-R-D-T, for those of you who look up the book, who's co-author of a trilogy of books with Antonio Negri called Empire, Multitude, and the newly released Commonwealth. He's a professor of literature and Italian at Duke University. And Michael Hart will be speaking in Baltimore at 7 p.m. tonight. The event is free and will be taking place at the 2640 space, which is located at 2640 St. Paul Street in Charles Village. The number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com or jump on to the Mark Steiner Facebook page and throw your thoughts and ideas there. There's some people doing that now. Got to figure out whether we'll use those now or in the next hour when we talk about corporations and their power in America. But join us online there if you'd like. And I'd like to hear from you. What are your thoughts about the idea that corporations can actually own a piece of your DNA, or they can own the tree that you want to plant in your backyard, and maybe you have to pay them if you want to replicate that tree or grow it somewhere else, or that they own a piece of a river, or they own the river you live on and can tell you what to do with that river? So your thoughts about that. I mean, think about somebody owning a piece of your bloodstream. 410-319-8888. It may be far-fetched, but it really isn't far-fetched. I mean,
no,
people have patents on all this stuff.
Right. Right. And I think that when people first learn about the, you know, the ownership of, you know, for instance, not just like a specific mouse or a specific apple tree, but a certain actually species of mouse and a certain variety of apple tree, then there's a certain kind of, let's say, indignation. I think indignation is the first response. But, and that seems, I mean, that's a perfectly, indignation's an excellent starting point for political activism. But
when we taking the point when people used to have, let's say, government subsidies, and they used to develop vaccines for people mm-hmm. to combat disease. And I think in Michael Moore's film, they focused on Jonas Salk, who mm-hmm. developed the polio vaccine. For people who are like my age, you remember polio was this thing when you were a kid in the 50s that you were like insane about because you thought you were going to die if you caught it. And well, it was real. It was a very yeah. real fear. But he created this vaccine. And we all got it, and we didn't catch polio, and we killed the disease. He didn't make money on that. He decided, I'm a scientist, and I'm going to create this vaccine because that's what I do. And I live well, and I'm paid well, but what I do is to offer this vaccine. But now, if you create a vaccine for anything or any kind of medicine, it's all about the millions you can make from the vaccine and not about what it takes to cure illness on the planet Earth.
Right. I think that the scientific knowledge is an excellent place to start for recognizing the characteristics and productivity of the common in this regard. Because in the scientific community, obviously, scientific knowledge can only be productive as long as it's common. Once it's privatized, it ceases to be productive. And so, you know, what university professors, but also scientists working in labs, what they do is they work from common knowledge to which they all have access to, and when they produce from that new knowledge is that they make common through journals and conferences, etc. And in that context, as you're perfectly well pointing out, in terms of both scientific community but also the pharmaceutical industry, etc., it's perfectly clear, I think, to everyone that this cycle of the common, you know, the common access, which allows for the new production of more common things, is interrupted or disrupted or even stopped when the common is made private. I think that characteristic, though, is also true in a variety of other what I'm thinking of as common goods or what I was referring earlier as biopolitical goods, like the production of ideas or the production of images, a number of other forms of social production that exist today, that it's only through open access, like it's when private property or even command, you know, of the boss enter into the equation, it lowers productivity, it makes unproductive these common goods. I think that's that's a contradiction within certain central aspect of capitalist production today, is that the privatization required for profits is actually destructive of productivity. And that's something that's constantly, I think, negotiated with and difficult within from the perspective of capital. From the perspective of us, it just provides a point of indignation, as you were saying before, but also of protest and political action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me hear our listeners think of 410-319-8888 as we talk with Michael Hart, who co-authored with Antonio Negri the books Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth. 410-319-8888. Tony, you're on the air.
Hello. Hello?
Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
This is Tommy.
Tommy.
Sorry. Tommy, right, you're on the air.
No problem. I just tuned in, and I wasn't sure that I heard what you were really getting into, but from what I've heard, it seems to me that the professor, you know, is on the right track, but the definition that I understand from my perspective is that what happens is what I would describe as effects, you know, he seems to be describing more or less in terms of being a cause or related to cause. I think of it as effects of what's going on. What I'm trying to say is there's a pre-existing cause that supersedes what he's talking about.
And what is that to you?
That to me is, you know, the original morphosis or metamorphosis of everything that we call material and spiritual and intellectual. It predates all of this. But what happens is over time it's all been co-opted and corrupted. That can be traced if you would just start to walk backwards in your mind and go back through history. It'll lead you to what I'm suggesting. It predates even the United States. And what happens is it seems to me that there's a global dynamic that discovered that they couldn't control the resources and the system and the people that produced the resources with the techniques that they were using. So they morphed it into what we see today. You know, and that's the things that you figure that you can patent a gene, you can patent a leaf, you can own a river, you can own a water. You can own people. It's the same thing. It's greed, and it's basically control, but it's control. And it's extremely subtle, and they're willing to take the time when they discovered what they couldn't do. And for the last 500 to 600 years, it's played itself out because they're right. Extremely patient. So
it's true. I mean, an example you used, I think you used, was in your book, Michael Hart, was about Bolivia.
Yeah.
Right? And about what got Evo Morales, an Indian, Bolivian Indian, elected president of Bolivia, the first Indian ever elected head of a nation of South Africa, you know, the majority of the people. That concept of owning the water was a piece of what threw him into power.
Yeah, that was – so this is the Evo Morales was elected in 2005, and these movements that led up to his election – at least starting in 2000, this so-called war on water and this so-called war on gas in 2003, both of them were really struggles over the common in this sense. The war on water in 2000 is a classic anti-neoliberalism struggle, because what happened was the International Monetary Fund told the Bolivian government at the time that its pricing of water was irrational, because what they meant by irrational was that it cost more for the government to get the water to these people than they were charging for it. And so they forced the government to sell the water rights to essentially a conglomerate of foreign corporations who then rationalized the water pricing so that they raised fourfold the water rates. And so viewing the water as common, you know, that the water is ours is what or more or less the movement said, it was one of the sparks in a way of taking back and defending the common in that sense. That would be – and I think that's one way in which I think when Tommy, the caller, is pointing out that these elements are not new, you know, that this notion of the common that's then being, you know, alienated or taken away by making it private is not something new. And I think that might be one instance, that one of the water struggle in Bolivia might be one way of seeing it that way. But I think also there's important ways in which there is something newly central about forms of the common within the capitalist economy. And so that in the same way that up until relatively recently, the factory production, industrial production of material goods was central and determinant. Of course, there were still the production of ideas, production of many other immaterial things. But that was central and determinant. Part of our claim in our books of my co-author and I is that industrial production, of course, is not declining quantitatively. There are people producing in factories all over the world, perhaps even more. But that is but factory production is no longer central in the economy in the same way, and that instead the production of the common in this sense, the production of these immaterial goods, is becoming central and determinant in the economy. So that would be, at least if that makes sense in a rough sense, that would be the way I would see this as not only an old and longstanding problem or struggle, as Tommy suggested, but also something that's newly urgent, let's say, and also offers new powers to workers. That would be another. That's another aspect of this.
I want to explore that aspect of it. Let me go back to the phones here first. 410-319-8888. And Sharon in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Sharon. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling. I think this might be related to what he's speaking to now, because I just heard. I'd like to know how he sees this increasing privatization of public education. With regard to what he's saying.
That's a really interesting point, because if you talk about a common in America, it's our public education, and it is becoming increasingly privatized.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that seems like an excellent excellent aspect of it. I mean, so when it also helps, I mean, Sharon's suggestion of that also helps to it. I don't mean to be talking about only these which are a very small sector of, say, software production or something like that. But also, I would say that healthcare, education, these are all also a kind of immaterial production. Because, of course, you know, what does the teacher do or the healthcare worker? I mean, the healthcare worker, of course, I don't know, stitches up wounds, changes bedpans, does many material things. But a lot of the job is also the production of affects, production of something immaterial, the production of a sense of well-being. And that's a lot of the job.
It's not a product.
It is, or it's an immaterial product, if you like.
Right.
And so, similarly in education, you're maybe not so much producing ideas actually in education, or at least in the teaching aspect of it, but also producing something quite immaterial. I mean, you could either say it's not a product, you know, that the students or the students' formation, mental formation, learning. Yeah, there you go. Learning. You could either say it's not a product, or as we're trying to do, we're thinking of it as a immaterial or biopolitical product.
But the act of taking public sectors,
yes,
and giving them to for-profit companies,
right?
I mean, one can make an argument that a school, as they're doing here, can be managed and run by a not-for-profit, by a community group,
right?
You know, that's happening more and more. But in our hospitals, they're becoming for-profit corporations, which force the non-profit hospitals to compete in a different way. You've got schools becoming privatized, so they get X amount of dollars for a student and make a profit off of those students, which separates them from the community in many ways and people's investment in education. And, you know, you can look at it here in Baltimore, where there are 30,000 abandoned houses and 17,000 empty lots that the city owns, or money that they own. So the question is that a common? Do we own that? Do we have the right to create urban agriculture and to create houses and homes to put people in and teach people how to make houses and homes that they can own? Or are those for the city to give and sell to private developers to make profits on? I mean, there are very concrete arguments over what's a common in our in our life.
And in each of these instances of the community gardens on the empty lot, or in terms of education, which is more complicated, I would want to ask, is there a way that we can assert our right to make that common and to organize it as common, so that neither a form of private property that could be bought and sold this way, or even something what we might think of as public property, meaning controlled by the state. I think, though, that also this issue of the privatization of public education has many interesting aspects to it. One thing that I think you see is interesting in regard to this is that one of the first and what I've found is most significant of the protest movements that resulted from the crisis, the economic and financial crisis of last fall, was a movement in Italy against the privatization of the high schools and university. And so and in doing that, a reduction of, you know, a raising of prices for students and a reduction of salaries for teachers, et cetera. And there was quite an interesting and powerful movement which sounds odd in English, it's called the anomalous wave, but it was of school teachers, university teachers and students against this, with the slogan was, we won't pay for your crisis, but it was involved, which is a good slogan. But it was the same kind of thing, that using privatization, even similar to the water example we were talking about in Bolivia a minute ago, using privatization as a way of raising the costs and lowering access at the same time in both of these. That's what the privatization does in both of these cases. Well,
but I think also that because of the power of business, certain private businesses and corporations to say, we have the right to own a hospital, we have the right to own a university, or we have a right to own a school, that, I mean, it is challenging what the whole idea of public means and what we hold as ours in common. I mean, that's what's, I mean, it's gotten so far since the 1930s, you know, when we created Glass-Steagall to put that wall between banks and investment companies, and it just kept deteriorating over the years after the 40s, that we now have this power that kind of says we have the right to make a profit, and if it doesn't make money, then and if it doesn't make a profit for us, then we shouldn't do it, and we can't do it.
Right. You know, this allows me to come back to something I said poorly at the beginning, which is that in the I'm always having this problem, which is in
too many languages in your head.
It could be when in this year of the financial crisis, mm-hmm. I think it's become clear to everyone that the previous commonplace taken for granted idea was the previous commonplace idea taken for granted of neoliberalism was if it's not privately owned, it will be mismanaged, and so that private ownership making things property was seen from that ideological perspective as making things either rational or efficient, etc. With that, now I think is, you know, almost universally debunked, let's say, you know, so that the idea of making it private, like public education, making it private is not, everyone knows, going to make it more efficient, more useful. And so, but the only other idea that I think that people go to in their head that we have as an alternative is, therefore, the state will run it. Like, therefore, it will be public property, be run by the state.
To what?
Well, that's the question. Is it possible to imagine a common management of such things, you know, that is not either state-regulated state property or organized as private property? What would self-organization and control of common goods be? I mean, it's at least easiest for me to start by just asking it as a question. What would that and then I suppose one could start by thinking of concrete examples of how that's done. That's one way of approaching it. And then there's another way of approaching it, which I tend to do at the same time, which is to think in more philosophical terms about what that self-management of the common would be. But I think that we've got into a kind of blindness to seeing things only as private property in the market controlled or state and government controlled, and have lost sight of the possibility of an alternative based on the common and certain forms of self-organization.
We have a caller who called and left a message for us. I'm going to read his question and invite you to join us at 410-319-8888 as well. I mean, do you think we have a right to a common ownership of things that are in our society and culture, whether it's the land along the water, whether it's the empty houses in Baltimore, our public education school system, the school in your neighborhood? I mean, or should they be privatized, or should they be owned by the larger government? What are your thoughts of that? 410-319-8888. A caller called in to say, which societies, if any, have successfully maintained the quote-unquote common goods approach?
I would agree. I don't think there's in some like global sense, I wouldn't point to any historical existing society. The fact, of course, that things haven't been done in the past, of course, doesn't mean that they can't be done in the future. Like, you could also say, well, what society has been democratic? Certainly not the United States or any of the Western European countries. I mean, what societies have the people actually ruled? And what, say, if people ruled through participatory schema? certainly hasn't happened yet, but we still, of course, have it as a ideal, sometimes as a guide
in
life.
Small places they have. I mean, like in Spain, what's the name of the corporation in Spain that came out of the Spanish Civil War? Is it Oregon? Is owned by the workers who work in those factories. And it's been a successful business for the last 70 years.
Right.
And owned by the workers who are inside
of it. And so in similar ways, you might say that we have examples of a variety of ways, not even just in small pockets in some place in Spain, but in all our societies, ways in which we do manage common goods collectively. In fact, I mean, scientific knowledge, I think, is one excellent element of that, let's say. But even in just our daily lives, there's a lot of ways in which we don't either have recourse to or take recourse to private property in order to control things, or even to the state. But it's done much more through circuits of self-organization. I mean, I think that's done in the community. That's the way the city works in general.
Because because of what we've done to our society in the last 60 years, I think we developed an idea and a consciousness among many of us, that unless you can make a lot of money at doing something, you will not do it. And that's a really common theme that's been put in our heads by the culture that the economic system we live in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless you're willing to make a profit off it, I'm not going to develop a drug that's going to stop AIDS,
right,
or HIV. If I can't make $100 million, I'm not going to do it. Well, I think that's a false notion.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. I think
it's a very recent idea.
Uh-huh. Right, and it doesn't really correspond to our lives. If you think why you do most things and why you expend energy and when you think about just the joys of creativity and producing things in all kinds of ways that it's outside of work, or I mean, it doesn't correspond. I mean, I think it's just, you're right that it doesn't make sense with the way we live and the way we act.
I mean, and even there's this capitalistic sense that one of my friends and mentors recently passed, Ray Blank, had this notion, and he made successful businesses out of them, where he said, you don't pay a salesperson a commission.
Mm-hmm.
You say, here's X amount of dollars. This is your salary. Go do your work and have a nice life and help us grow. And it works better than the other way. We've twisted everything in this culture to think that it's only personal aggrandizement that makes it work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that. Let's see if we can get. Can we sneak one quick caller in here? 410-319-8888. At least one. Alex, you're on the air.
All right. I just wanted to, talk about, whether you can find that middle ground.
Okay.
You know, between private and public, and it seems like the times that it has worked is when the population is under 150, as Jared Diamond and Guns, Germs, and Steel would point out, and Malcolm Gladwell talks about this, and you know, 150 is as many people as we can remember, self-organize with. So, it would work if the population wasn't so big, but. That's when I see it work, and I think it's been pointed out before.
Very quick thought before we have to kind of run out of here. I'm sorry.
No, that seems that doesn't seem to me like a bad starting point. But of course, such small numbers of the number of people you can remember or something like that doesn't have to be the ending point. That might be the way I would start with it, to think about the ways of it. You know, starting with such experiments and increasing them, but then think about how to work towards larger scale. I mean, I can think of one example, and this is maybe because I'm like university professor and have that problem, is Jefferson toward the end of his life, Thomas Jefferson, he was proposing these ward system, which he called the small republics, which were based around the size of like an elementary school or something, where everyone could participate.
Right.
But that they were each that government would have to be, for in order to be truly Republican, as he said, it would have to involve a delegation from that small republic to the next level and to the next level. And so that the people were constantly and every day deciding on the largest concerns of the nation.
Despite his being a slaveholder, he had some good ideas.
Exactly. Yeah.
That was not one of them, though. But right. The one you described was. Mm-hmm. Michael Hart, co-author of a trilogy of books with Antonio Negri, Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth, which just came out. Professor of Literature and Italian at Duke University. You can hear him in just 1 hour from now at 7 o'clock at 2640 Space, which is at 2640 St. Paul Street in Charles Village. Join him there. Have a great evening and continue this conversation. Pleasure to meet you, Michael Hart. Yep. Thank you
Thanks
so much for
having
being
me.
Here. We're going to take a short break and come right back. I have to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland, Marlene and Stuart Greenbaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure for cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org or call 1-800-888-8823. We'll be right back to look at our economy, Congress, and what they're doing to us, and what we should have them do for us. Stay with us.